You're listening to a Rig Train Masterclass, supported by the Radio Independence Group and Creative Skillset, independent training for the UK radio production industry.
Generally speaking, if I'm at a major sporting event, I am presenting it, I'm saying, here we are at Twickenham, which I'm doing this Saturday night. Twickenham, it's Italy against France, second match of the Rugby World Cup. Joining me in the commentary box will be Ian Robertson and Ugo Monia, I think is our expert summariser. And then we'll have a touchline reporter as well, who'll be there to do the interviews afterwards. So if you imagine that I'm the presenter, Rob's the commentator, Becky is the expert summariser, and Kevin is the pitch side reporter going out to do the interviews. So they're quite different roles with different expectations on all of them. It's different between radio and TV. It's different between commentator and summariser. Actually, funnily enough, I little mini name drop here. I bumped into Barry Davis in the street a couple of weeks ago, and he was quite nervous. You know, the man who was broadcast on. Actually, we talk about Olympic Games. Barry makes me look like a rank amateur. I don't know how many Olympics Barry's done, but he's done obviously loads of football matches for TV over the years, FA Cup finals, World Cups. But he was nervous because he was about to do a radio commentary for Absolute Radio, and he hadn't done radio commentary since he was in his 20s. So for him, it's quite a nerve-wracking thing. It's the case that not all ex-athletes make good broadcasters. No. Some have to be trained a lot. I remember being in Broadcasting House in London when Gary Lineker came in to present for the first time, so quite soon after the 1990 World Cup. So he probably retired a couple of seasons yeah. after that.
Yeah.
So Five Live signed him up, not just to be a pundit, but to present a show on a Sunday afternoon. And he will admit that he was frankly dreadful, partly because he has this rather drony Leicester voice, and still has a rather drony Leicester voice. But actually, what he does have is a lot of humour and a lot of personality, and he's just got better at it because he's done it for a long time. But on radio, it was painful. Another ex-England footballer that I worked with was Graham Nassau. We did about 6 months after he retired of co-presenting the Sunday afternoon programme. And to co-present a programme means that obviously you've got two presenters who theoretically share the burden equally or share the responsibilities of introducing matches, introducing interviews, talking to people. And Graham is a very, very natural pundit. You know, he's a highly intelligent bloke. He's, you know, reads the game very well. Kevin, you've worked with him as well. But actually, when it came to doing that thing, you know, he would suddenly freeze and go, right, I'm doing radio now. You know, I'm not just talking to Ellie. You know, we're not having a conversation. Or even, he was quite good at doing interviews because he's a natural communicator. But when it came to, right, I've now got to introduce this interview, which we have done earlier, he would start reading like that. And you'd think, how do I get you to stop doing that if you've got an ex-sportsman who's had a couple of years away from it, has just had a little bit of, is not so close to the dressing room as maybe, well, I mean, I just think about Graham Swan, for example, who I think is brilliant on the radio and a fantastic commentator and very, very funny. And there is somebody that you identified 10 years, even before he retired, as a future broadcaster. But I think he maybe was almost too honest too early on, actually. If you do support a team and you are reporting on football matches or covering football, there's almost a tendency to over-criticise your own team.
True.
You know, that you are... Because you know your team so well and you get angry if they're doing badly, that you will be more likely to give them a kicking. And actually, it's very interesting. If you listen to some of the commentators, you say you don't know who they support, generally speaking. But sometimes people will say... can we reveal that Alan Green, who Alan Green supports... I think
you
we can. I think
you
we can reveal.
Right, you know,
just between us. Greeny supports Liverpool.
Yeah.
But a lot of people will say, "Bloody Man United supporter," because he can be so critical of Liverpool that they assume that he must support Man United, because he's you know slagging off Liverpool. But actually, it's the other way around. So that's quite interesting. It's like when both sides of the government, you know, when the Conservatives and Labour are attacking the BBC at the same time, you know you're doing something right. Because, you know, you're hopefully treading a middle ground. I think actually cricket is interesting because you look at the commentary box and radio now and a significant number are ex-players, although not all, actually. As I think about TMS this year, we've got Jonathan Agnew. You forget in some ways that he played for England. He didn't play for very much for England, but he did play for England, as he's always being reminded by Geoffrey Boycott, and Ed Smith. But then you also have Simon Mann and Henry Blofeld, who are not ex-professionals. You know, they are natural broadcasters. But it is that ability, again, to be able to use the language and to describe a scene, and particularly with cricket, when you're talking for hours on end, if you haven't got an ability to paint a picture, like Rob was saying, and just to give it some light and shade as well, and to use the down times in cricket. Even if you haven't thought about it before you've gone to the ground or the venue, you know, the pool or whatever, you might have in your head what the significance might be in the end. So for example, when Becky was winning her medals in Beijing, you know, Anita Lonsborough, who was the last woman to win a gold medal in swimming, was sitting just a few rows in front. And so you're thinking, you know, right, okay, we've got to mention Anita at some point. So you might just say, Becky Adlington takes on the mantle of Anita Lonsborough, who is here in the pool watching. And you've prepared in your mind that she's there, but you wouldn't have thought beforehand, you know, until you get there, you know, and you see Anita there, that thought wouldn't have necessarily occurred to you. But it's about using your eyes and thinking about what might actually add to the picture that you're trying to paint. If, as a presenter or as an interviewer, you can keep eye contact with the person you're interviewing, it makes such a big difference. There is nothing worse, and I see it sometimes if I'm presenting a programme in the studio, that the person who's doing the interview is sitting there looking at their next script. So somebody can be answering a question, and the person who's supposedly getting, you know, and there can be people who are quite nervous, who are just ordinary people off the street, basically, you know, or just people who've had some kind of experience, and they feel it's an unnatural situation to be in. And if the person who is trying to do the interview with you is looking at a screen, I think that is, you wreck the interview straight away. So I've actually done judo now at three different Olympics, and London was the most recent one. And actually, obviously, we had a pretty successful time in the judo hall this time. But my view when it comes to doing minority sports, for want of a better word, is that you cannot assume a great deal of knowledge from the audience. But at the same time, you've got people out there who are massive judo experts and judo fans. So if you're doing a new sport at an Olympic Games, I tend to think you go in with that much knowledge. And there are people out there with that much knowledge. But actually, what you want to do is to kind of get yourself to about there, because the audience probably have that much knowledge. So you don't want to kind of overdo it. So I went into London thinking, you cannot describe techniques and get it wrong, because a lot of the techniques, a lot of the throws, the holds, the strangles in judo have got Japanese names. So the audience don't know what you're describing. You know, the experts might do, but the vast majority of the audience don't know. So you've kind of got to find ways of doing it. You know, you could say it's a knockout, it's a shoulder throw, it's a leg throw. You could kind of get a little bit more technical like that. And also, you know, I'm not an expert because I only do this every 4 years. But when it came to Karina Bryant on the last day in the heavyweight category, and she was fighting for the bronze medal, and she got her opponent with a shoulder throw, and by that stage I'd been watching it all week, and I thought, that is an uchimata. So I said, and she's got her with an uchimata. And I thought, God, I hope I've got that right. I really hope I've got that right. But there is a little computer screen in front of you, and a couple of seconds later it came up with the name of the technique, and it said uchimata. And I thought, that is my greatest day in radio ever, that I actually managed to correctly call a throw in judo after 4 times of doing it. I've been doing it now for many, many years. And I started in 1984. When there were no female broadcasters really at all, and actually when I was 15, I decided I wanted to be a female cricket reporter, and you know, and there were no women working in the sports media then, pretty much. So at the just the very, very, very short answer to what is actually quite a long thing. I never found anyone standing in my way. I never had anyone say to me, "You cannot do this because you're a woman." In fact, the opposite. My very first boss in local radio, when I said I wanted to report on cricket, said, OK, here's a phone. This is in commercial radio as well. Here's a phone. Go down to New Road in Worcester. Phone in every hour on the hour, and we'll take a report into the news bulletin. So, you know, and he's now actually in charge of local radio. David Holdsworth is his name. And he was amazingly encouraging to me at the start of my career. So, and as time has gone on, you know, you get patronised sometimes, you know, in the world of football. Actually, I was telling... very quick story about Joe Royle, who was Everton manager, the first time I did Sports Report, first woman to present Sports Report, 1996, quite a big deal. And you say, it's 5 o'clock, time for Sports Report. And how many people know what comes next? So, yeah, pretty nerve-wracking. Joe Royle, first up to be interviewed. Everton had just won the Merseyside Derby that day. He was manager of Everton that had a rotten start to the season. And so I said, well, Joe, congratulations. Great result for Everton. You know, everyone on the blue side of Merseyside will be thrilled to bits for you. But you've been in the game long enough to know that one swallow doesn't make a summer. And he said, only a woman would ask that question. And you just think, and actually we were talking about this earlier on out there, and I came up with the perfect answer 19 years later. What I should have said was, only a manager under pressure would have come up with that response. But of course I didn't say that, you know, because you just don't in that moment. But those have been very rare examples. But I think going back to the question of female commentators, I think that is still a barrier which has yet to be broken down to any great extent, because it's about trust, isn't it? It's about whether people trust you to be able to tell the story properly, you know, that they feel comfortable with you as a broadcaster and as a commentator. And I think now that people feel pretty comfortable with me as a presenter, because I've been doing it for such a long time, there is less fear out there than there once was. I think if you go back 15, 20 years, people were very worried, particularly in TV, actually, because TV rights are so much more, you know, competitive in lots of ways, that people would not say anything for fear of being, you know, of losing the rights. And there was a lot of pressure on sport and news to be seen as very separate. I think we are less worried about that now. I think maybe sports governing bodies have become braver and more able to accept that things aren't perfect the whole time. There's the right time and the place for those discussions. And certainly if you look at Five Live, I mean, you know, obviously most of all of us work for Five Live in some capacity, over the whole piece, if you like, you know, so over a World Championships, you will be getting a lot of discussions during the World Athletics Championships, for example, about drugs. You know, we spend a lot of time talking about drugs. But actually there are times when it's the 100 metres race. Everybody knows the history of Justin Gatlin. You know, everyone knows the pressure on Usain Bolt. You don't have to kind of say that while you're commentating at the same time, you know, and you've got to be able to not judge, you know, not be judgmental. And I know what you're saying about Test Match Sofa, and I think that there is the BBC requirement to be fair and impartial as well. Yeah. But then to use people who've got strong opinions and brave views as well. But David Law, who is a brilliant commentator for radio and really knows his stuff, has this thing where he rocks backwards and forwards when he's commentating. When he's excited, he'll do that. And he hated it. He hated the fact that people could look at him rocking backwards and forwards. He said, it makes me look weird. And I think that's the point, in a way. Radio should be different from TV. You don't have to wait until they give the scores at half-time and at full-time to know what the score is. I actually had a conversation with some people recently where they said, should we get rid of the classified football results? And you think, that would be just unthinkable to get rid of the classified, you know, that 5 o'clock on a Saturday afternoon. Cannot imagine that happening. But it's an argument that you could have, I suppose, because of, you know, the fact that scores are there instantly. A lot of what we do is about consuming radio in different ways. So one of the big things that we have is obviously the In Short on Five Live In Short, so using social media as well. You know, we're very much kind of talking about sharing content in other ways. But when it comes to live events, I mean, I still think live events, people, if you're in your car and it's the Rugby World Cup final, you know, of course you're going to listen to it. Or if you're in your kitchen, or if you're out doing other things, you know, those moments of live appointment to listen radio have still got to be there. So, you know, so that first morning at Trent Bridge, for example, you mentioned that test match when Stuart Broad just ripped through the Australians. You know, it was one of those where people were, well, I was on holiday and I just could not tear myself away from my radio. You know, I just sat there. I thought, I'm on a holiday. But it was so amazing that I think if you can persuade people that that's the way to do it. And I think with Rugby World Cup coming up as well, that's going to be a big challenge. One of the interesting things that we did during Wimbledon was have webcams in the commentary box. And we mentioned this earlier on. And that's great in lots of ways, because people can then see Martina Navratilova and Pat Cash in the commentary box with David Law, but they can't see the action.
You've been listening to a Rig Train Masterclass, supported by the Radio Independence Group and Creative Skillset, independent training for the UK radio production industry.